Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Ramita Iyer, research analyst at the Institute. With the robust progress made in the negotiations, South Asia Chat is currently running a three-part series on the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. In case you missed the first two episodes, do listen to them. We had Professor Peter Draper and Ms. R.V. Anuradha, who provided perspectives from Australia and India. You can also get more information on the IPEF and its evolution in episodes 146 and 186. In this final episode of the IPEF series, I'm pleased to be joined by two experts. Dr. Kekumol Pitakdumrongit Karen, Assistant Professor and Head of the Center for Multilateralism Studies at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, NTU, and Ms. Priyanka Kishore, Economic and Forum Director, IMA Asia, Singapore. Karen will discuss Thailand's perspective on the IPEF, while Priyanka will reflect on the broader regional landscape. Karen and Priyanka, welcome to the podcast. So I'd like to start off this conversation with the recent moment of success in the IPEF negotiations, with the substantive conclusion of talks on Pillar 2 on supply chains, which was announced in the ministerial meeting in Detroit last month. Karen, could you share the potential benefits and challenges in the agreement? Have Thailand's expectations been fulfilled?
Yes, okay. Maybe first of all, I'll tell you why Thailand's interested particularly in Pillar 2 of IPEF, which is on supply chain. Thailand, as you know, we are very open in terms to international trade. Our trade openness is about 110% GDP. So we really suffer from the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, the supply chain disruption. And also we are tourism reliant economy, so we suffer a lot on that front as well. So supply chain pillar, especially the supply chain agreement that came out of the Detroit ministerial meeting in late May last month, really received really well in as far as Thai government is concerned, because as you know, the supply chain agreement is proposing to set up three mechanisms, right? The Supply Chain Council, which is actually considered to be crisis prevention mechanism, as it plans to devise sector-specific action plans for critical sectors. Also, another mechanism that came out of this agreement is called Supply Chain Risk Response Network, which is supposed to be a crisis response mechanism, and as it will set up emergency communication channel to facilitate information sharing. Another mechanism is Labor Rights Advisory Council. So as you know, this is a body to ensure that the labor rights are protected as far as supply chain cooperation is concerned. So overall, Thailand really likes to see this agreement comes to fruition. As I mentioned earlier, we suffer from COVID-19 pandemic, and Thailand thinks that this is going to be great for the region as well. As you know, in the early months of COVID-19 pandemic, we witnessed a lot of export restrictions, a lot of export bans, right? Which is actually not very good for, you know, fostering supply chains in the region. And for Thailand as well, because it lacks information on the supply side, the Thai government actually banned chicken eggs because of no data. The logic is that the government view that chicken eggs is actually a source of protein for the poor Thais, so they went ahead and banned the chicken egg export for a few months because they think that this will safeguard some eggs for the poor Thai to consume during the pandemic. So we'd like to prevent this from happening again if another crisis hits. So supply chain agreement is really well received by Thailand.
So much like the concerns voiced by other member countries like India, Thailand too has been cautious of certain provisions under the IPEF, especially with those regarding digital economy and labor standards. As you mentioned, there was, as part of the supply chains agreement, there was also a proposed establishment of a tripartite labor rights advisory board. What are Thailand's concerns in this regard, both from the perspective of the government as well as the business community?
Maybe I'll start with talking about what the IPEF means for Thailand from both government perspective and from business perspective, right? So because the views on IPEF relies on who you talk to, right? So for the government's perspective, Thailand does not see IPEF as a replacement of FTA. I think the Biden administration made clear at the beginning that this is not a FTA that we use to engage, right? But Thailand see IPEF as a way to continue to engage the U.S. because we don't have U.S. Thailand FTA. So this is another pathway or mechanism that we can leverage to foster economic cooperation with the U.S. And I think that the objectives of IPEF sync with the agenda that Thailand is pursuing. For example, we are pursuing the 13th National Economic and Social Development Plan, which aims for boosting per capita income, narrowing income gap, and lessening greenhouse gas emission. We also pursuing what we call Eastern Economic Corridor, or EEC in short. So we see this as another project that will be beginning from our participation in IPEF, because EEC is a scheme that strives to transform the nation's eastern part into the regional production hub of the high-end, high-tech industries. Okay, so for the government perspective, they tend to think in terms of economic gains as well as the geopolitical gains as well. So Thailand we know that the U.S.-China rivalry has been intensifying, and IPEF is actually labeled as part of the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Right. So Thailand noticed that because of the intensifying geopolitical dynamic, especially the U.S.-China rivalry, there has been a new concept such as, friendshoring, the ways that governments handle their supply chain, etc. So Thailand feel that the IPEF could be another platform, another mechanism to discuss the new ways of doing business in this current geopolitical environment. So that would be the government's perspective on IPEF. For private sector, well, to be honest with you, the Thai private sector is not well aware of how IPEF is going, because most of the businesses that I talked to in my research tend to not sure whether they can benefit or lose from this framework, because IPEF is not a standard FTA that they are familiar with, right? But in general, they tend to welcome the framework. They think that, okay, this is another pathway to foster collaboration with the U.S. and with other regional economies. So, but they don't have clear idea of whether or not which position they should take, because they're not sure whether they'll benefit or lose from the IPEF. So that would what I gather from the business sector side. I can foresee that Thailand is facing some challenges when negotiating for Pillar 1, especially for the digital economy and labor standard. So for one thing, despite the fact that we are, in terms of e-commerce market, we are the second largest in Southeast Asia, but the progress of fostering, what we call transnational digital governance architectures, for Thailand, we tend to lag behind our regional peers. Even though we are a signatory to the RCEP agreement, which contains the e-commerce chapter, we are neither in CPTPP or engaged in any kind of digital economy agreement, signing onto any like DEPA or DEA that Singapore signed with other countries, right? At the World Trade Organization level, Thailand is not participating in the talks on trade-related aspect of e-commerce. So as you can see, the gaps in rulemaking would hinder Thailand's participation in the trade pillar as far as digital economy is concerned. And also, if you look at our domestic laws and the discrepancy between our laws and the other framework, there's a gap there. There's a significant gap there. For example, Thailand just implemented the Personal Data Protection Act of 2019. So this act, if you look into the content, it's actually largely derived from the European Union General Data Protection Regulation, or known as GDPR. right? And as you know, GDPR is regarded as the world's toughest data privacy and security legislation. So I would because if you look at the PDP of Thailand, Section 28, it puts restriction on transnational transfer of data. So the transmission, especially for the personal data, are permitted only to the destination that provide adequate level of protection. So if you look into this content, you'll see that Thailand PDPA will clash with CPTPP and USMCA, which both uphold, you know, the free movement of digital data, right? So I think the gap between Thailand, the discrepancy between Thailand's law and CPTPP and USMCA, the framework that are being negotiated, that being looked into in terms of coming up with the agreement at IPEF, would prevent Thailand from reaching some agreement pertaining to cross border data transmission. So as far as labor standard is concerned, I think Thailand is facing some challenges on that front as well. Well, as you know, the USTR is leading the negotiation in Pillar 2, so Pillar 1 from the US, right? So USTR, as we know, its position is consistent, is pro-labor. And but if you look at the Bangkok, Thailand's international commitment to, like, for example, the International Labor Organization, the ILO conventions, well, we committed to some, but USMCA, the framework that USTR is insisting to put into the labor standard cooperation in IPEF, it has Chapter 23 on labor, USMCA Chapter 23 on labor, said does not require, of course, it doesn't require the adoption of ILO convention, but it stresses the need to uphold the ILO Declaration on the Rights at Work. And if you look closely into this ILO declaration, it asks it mandates that all the country, all the members in ILO, even though they ratify the conventions or not, have an obligation to uphold, respect, promote, and realize some principles regarding fundamental labor rights that are subject of those conventions, right? For example, they ask the member to uphold the freedom of association, elimination of all form of forced labor, abolition of child labor, elimination of discrimination in workplace, and the safe and healthy working environment. Right. So my concern is that even though Thailand ratified several ILO conventions, but we still hasn't ratified, for example, the freedom of association or protection of the right to organize convention, which is ILO number 87. And we haven't ratified the right to organize and collective bargaining convention, which is ILO number 98. So I would think that if the challenge will emerge if the US frequently rejects Thailand equivalent legislation on this front and demand Thailand to upgrade or adjust its domestic law to be closer to what US aspires to, that would lead to a clash doing and negotiation and we pose challenge to Thailand on that front.
Priyanka, you've been tracking the IPEF adopting a broader regional lens. Over the past couple of decades, we see that trade has been a driving force of economic development in the region. Today, APAC accounts for almost half of the global preferential trade agreements. Now, as Karen briefly touched upon this, the IPEF deviates from this traditional framework. It does not offer any market concessions and instead focuses on standard setting. Given this, how does the IPEF compare to the existing multilateral trade agreements, especially the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, and the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP?
Now, you know, to begin with, some might even find this comparison problematic, as the Biden administration has been at pains to emphasize that the IPEF is not a trade, but an economic agreement. But I think it is difficult to fully come to terms with this description, as the IPEF has many aspects of a trade policy. And as you mentioned, the US is leveraging it to set rules across a gamut of trade, digital economy, labor, and environmental standards. So I think it's quite fair to make this comparison of IPEF with existing FTAs, and especially CPTPP and the RCEP. Now, when we view the IPEF as a trade agreement, it falls short of traditional FTAs on most key parameters. You have already touched, you and Karen have already touched upon the market access part, which in fact has even led to some protests in the from the US businesses who do not see what the IPEF is doing for them. But moving on to the other thing that the IPEF wants to achieve, which is the aim of positioning the US as the chief rule setter in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, like the CPTPP, which of course has kept many of the provisions of the US-led TPP, the IPEF aims to elevate labor, environmental, and regulatory standards in this part of the world to that of the US. But this goal is problematic because it's looking to set similar operating standards across a diverse set of economies at different stages of development. Because of its flexible approach, IPEF does not keep out, like CPTPP, potential members that they think might not be able to implement the standards that come into play. And so, for example, you know, India is a good example where, you know, it has opted to stay out of the trade pillar because it does not think it can conform to the rules that the US is seeking to set, but has joined the other pillars. Now, this is even more so in the case of IPEF because it does not have an enforcement mechanism, which exists both in the RCEP as well as the CPTPP. We have a fair economy pillar, and that talks about anti-corruption measures and tax transparency, but there is no built-in provision for a legal dispute settlement mechanism. These are to be monitored and resolved by the members within their domestic legal frameworks as per the applicable IPEF standards. Now this leaves a lot to the motivations of the members to cooperate and that everybody will work in good faith. Another challenge for the IPEF, and I think this is a big one, is the high level of private sector participation and information sharing that it requires. Now, Karen, of course, touched upon it by saying that the private sector does not quite know what to make out of it. But key to the success of IPEF is actually them coming on board because, for example, the resilient supply chain pillar that pretty much rests on information sharing that can come from these companies so that IPEF can develop early warning signals of supply chain disruptions. Information sharing is a challenge even for normal FTAs, especially from the small and medium-sized enterprises. We've had surveys in ASEAN where they have cited lack of information and privacy issues as key reasons for not participating. And such a large commitment on the part of businesses to share private data with the governments requires some concrete incentives and a stronger motivation than the IPEF is currently projecting. And to that extent, I feel that the success of IPEF is riding a lot on what they can do in terms of getting businesses on board. And at this point, it's not clear that they have that action plan in place. And finally, I think the point I would make is that IPEF suffers from weak perception. Both CPTPP and RCEP are viewed as positive for APAC's economic prospects. At the very least, they are not expected to leave it worse off. But the same unanimity does not seem to exist on the IPEF. Some view it as divisive and a tool to counter rising Chinese hegemony in the region. The agreement not only excludes the mainland, which is not surprising, but also Cambodia and Laos, as they are considered to be heavily under Chinese influence. This, I think, is a challenge for Asia's neutrality, and in particular, the philosophy of the region that we are sitting in, ASEAN centrality, because that seeks to maintain a balanced relationship between Southeast Asia and dominant external powers, and IPEF is sort of posing a risk to this stance.
So on the one side, as you highlighted, the IPEF seems to be riddled with challenges and potentially even falls short of the promises offered by the existing regional agreements. Nonetheless, the framework with its vast membership of 14 countries at different stages of development does seem to present a formidable economic potential as a novel approach to economic engagement in the region. Could you share on the attractiveness or the value add of the IPEF for these member countries and what is in it for them?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point you're making, Ramita. The countries, the APEC countries that have been invited to join the IPEF have embraced it very quickly. And I can share some figures with you from the 2023 State of Southeast Asia report, which is released by ICS. And according to them, most see the presence of US in the region as an important check to rising Chinese dominance, and hence there is no downside to joining the IPEF. So it's more like rather be in it rather than be left out. So 46.5% of the respondents see a positive impact of the IPEF on the region. Around 42% are unsure of the impact, but only 12% consider it negative. So, you know, what we read in the commentaries about its divisiveness, it's not actually reflected so much in the survey as it is that it might cause the region to fragment more. More importantly, and good for the US, I guess, the survey results coincide also with a decline in the perception of China as the key economic, political, and strategic influence in ASEAN, while the view on the position of the US in the region has improved. So I think that's what was one of the key aims of IPEF, and that seems to be working. Now, why is that so? I would say first and foremost, it brings a very important trading and strategic partner back to the table on the economic front rather than just the strategic and the security front where the US has been engaging in. We all know that under President Trump, the US grew more and more estranged from Asia. He paid little attention to Southeast Asia, imposed tariffs that not only hit China, but also traditional US allies like South Korea, Australia. He threatened to withdraw US military support from South Korea and Japan. And even, you know, India, which seemed to have a better relationship with the Trump administration, lost its preferential trade status. And this sort of setback, the US-APEC relationship, and triggered an erosion of the US influence in the region. China was, of course, quick to take the opportunity and increased its heft. Now, IPEF is Biden administration's attempt to regain this lost ground in APEC and re-engage with the regional allies on key trade, supply chain, climate, economic security, etc. issues. And as I said right at the start, most are welcoming this as a check to China's influence in the region. So it's more like they would have both the regional powers rather than tilt towards one, the balanced view. Now, in addition to that, if we take a step back and not view the IPEF as a trade agreement and try to see it as an economic agreement, which is what the US administration would want us to do, we do see there are some positives. So I think the first one is its large reach. That comes from the fact that it's much easier to join IPEF. And if you are a member of IPEF as well as RCEP and CPTPP, it actually means that you have access to a pretty wide market spanning three continents. So that really enhances the scope of these agreements. And this could actually encourage more nations to make efforts to join all three, leading to more improved and uniform standards across, you know, trade and economic areas, many of these areas. The second one, I would say, you know, just like it brings the US to the table, it also provides its members a segue into India, which has shunned multilateral trade agreements so far. And it has also stayed out of the trade pillar of the IPEF, so to say, but it is beginning to engage into bilateral FTAs. And if you wanted to have a conversation going with India on an FTA, IPEF probably provides a platform to do so. Now, this is a welcome development, for example, for New Zealand, which is keen to develop such ties with India. We have talked about the lack of direct market access. But the IPEF does bring prospects of more US FDI into APEC and benefits of knowledge sharing, particularly in niche technologies like advanced biofuels, green hydrogen, carbon capture, and storage. So, of course, you know, the first is already happening in terms of more FDI coming as a part of China Plus One, which is pushing US companies to look elsewhere to de-risk and diversify their supply chains. To give an idea, US FDI in Asia Pacific stood at nearly $1 trillion in 2021. This is double at what it was at the start of the decade. But ThaiPEF can, of course, give this an added push, and this also benefits from the RCEP's common rule of origin, which will allow the firms to use the region as one production base. So this could be an example of two of these agreements coming together to benefit the region. The last two, I would say, are more aspirational benefits of IPEF, but nonetheless, they could work in its favor. It would require some resetting of the US approach to IPEF. I mentioned earlier how the IPEF is seen as setting US rules in the region, but it's not necessary that be the case. You know, India, Indonesia, Thailand, they all have relatively stricter existing digital economy rules, and it could serve the IPEF well to take these into considerations when these pillars are being finalized. The green economy pillar as well, the Singapore-Australia Green Economy Agreement, could very well become a template for the green economy pillar. And if the IPEF is able to achieve a shared common understanding that leads to motivation for you know, enforcing this, because as we said, while you can join IPEF, there is no mechanism that forces you to actually implement IPEF. But if you see benefits coming in through these channels, then it will also help members to lift their standards. For example, like CPTPP, they do have to put in certain reform parts in place to join. IPEF could also become like that. And members could use RCEP as a stepping stone to upgrade to IPEF's more stringent standards. Over time, this will also help RCEP raise its own standard and shed its tag of a low-quality agreement. So it really depends a lot on, you know, what shape and you know, mechanisms are finally adopted inside the broad contours of IPEF.
Finally, coming back to the negotiations, we see that progress has also been made on the remaining three pillars of the IPEF, on trade, clean economy, and fair economy. There's also this expectation that the negotiations will be concluded by November 2023 in time for the APEC summit meeting. Karen, what are your thoughts on the possibility of its conclusion within such a tight timeline, and what would be the potential nature of the IPEF at the end of the year?
Okay, I would think that at the end of the year, we'll probably see the outcomes in both binding as well as non-binding. In terms of the binding, I think we'll probably see the supply chain agreement, given the fact, well, assuming that the country can crank out details that they agree upon. So we'll probably see the supply chain agreement coming out at the end of this year. And for non-binding, I think they'll probably have several as well. Most of them probably focus on capacity training, because as you know, the cooperation in Pillar 3 and Pillar 4, Pillar 3 is green economy, Pillar 4 is fair economy, right? So this would involve a lot of capacity training, especially for the developing members of IPEF to make them, you know, to close the gap between themselves and the more developed members of IPEF. So I think the non-binding would come in form of capacity training project, etc. Yep. So I think that would be the outcome, what we expect to see by November.
Priyanka, could you also share your views on this?
Sure. I mean, I think there is a strong geopolitical urgency to push IPEF ahead, which is why we have seen the supply chain pillar being concluded so quickly. And talks that it might even be the whole agreement might be in force in some form by November of this year. Of course, you know, the upcoming US elections are sort of a reason, a motivation for this. Now, I'm sure, you know, if pushed, given the speed that this is going, we could get some sort of statements come out for all four pillars by November, which would probably make it one of the fastest agreements, trade or economic, being concluded in history, I guess. But in terms of the actual substance, given the speed at which we have to go, I think it would really leave a lot on the table to be negotiated in terms of how you might have actual treaties being implemented, maybe under these pillars, or you know, some sort of, as Karen spoke about, capacity trainings, or what kind of knowledge sharing arrangements might come to through. So while on paper it might be concluded, the implementation is something that will still probably have to be thought through in terms of mechanisms.
Priyanka and Karen, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on social media. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.